then this is sort of another numerical type question. This is sort of a, I don't know, you may not even be able to answer it. I don't know, it's sort of a speculative question. But from 62 onward, only 11 of the remaining 38 cases are in the U.S. And since 72, it's only 6 of the last 25. So what do you think is the reasoning behind the growth of international cases as the book goes on?
I don't think, again, there's any I don't know. I mean, I just collected all the data, threw away the stuff that was, real junk, and there was only 3 or 4 cases like that, and just put it down. And I can't really read anything into it other than I think it's again, just data bias, and that as the author, I don't have anybody that I can call up in Turkey or China or Brazil. I mean, there's some, A.J. Gravard and a few people, but what you really want is somebody that's been around the block for 10, 20 years that's familiar with some of these cases and has looked at them and feels comfortable that they're not hooey.
Yeah.
So I don't read much into it other than I think the density is uniform and continue to crash. And I know that NORAD continues to track them, and I know that the Project Moondust people that pick up space junk continue to probably find stuff that's not space junk but out of this world.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, as a testament to the book, like I said when I was going through the thing, it's not just the U.S. and the U.K. and the sort of countries you'd expect. There's actually, there was 19 countries, pretty much, that are featured in the book that there is a crash of some sort at.
Yeah,
so I thought
well,
that
that's
was
good.
Amazing.
I'm glad you did that. I didn't know there was 19 countries. That's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, and we got France and Canada.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Yeah, I got the list here. So, Wales had a couple. Australia with 3, Bolivia with 2, Peru had 1, like you said, the Congo, Iceland, Ukraine, some place called Somaliland that I've never even heard of.
It's in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, in Scotland. It's pretty amazing that there's, it's like you said, it's if there was more of a unified sort of UFO field throughout the world, like you said, I think the crashes would be much higher.
Right, and I think there are, in some countries, I think there is quite a bit. I mean, in Japan, like, I don't have any in Japan. And I know there's got to be some in Japan.
Yeah.
And Japan has a very strong, UFO focus. And I just don't have any contacts in Japan, but I want to get there.
Yeah.
And China's the same way. It's a huge land, and although it's been a pretty closed society for a long time, but maybe we could get some info out of there.
Yeah, and like you said, India too probably has a lot.
Yeah, India, right? India. I mean, the whole India would be good because it's English speaking, and there's a lot of people, a lot of witnesses. I'm sure there's several there.
Yeah.
I haven't plugged into that field.
Yeah. Is there much of a ufology field in India? I mean, you don't hear from too many people coming out of there other than the India Daily stuff.
Well, that's a good question, and I don't really know. I mean, what I would do is typically take the MUFON journal or the MUFON proceedings and look here. For the international foreign representatives. So there seems to be good foreign representation in the following cities, at least for the largest UFO organization: Ukraine, Turkey, Thailand, Taiwan, Switzerland, Sweden, Spain, Russia, Romania, Prague, Netherlands, Mexico, Malta, Israel, Hong Kong. Hong Kong would be interesting because they might get you into China. Guatemala, Cyprus, China. There's somebody in China. Belgium, Australia, and Austria. So you get a little bit of Europe. Those are the people that I could instantly write an email to.
Yeah.
And actually, that's a good idea. I should do that. And and ask them to see if we can get some more, you know, send them a list and see if there's any other crashes that they're aware of.
Yeah, but no India, see? That's
yeah,
strange.
No India, right.
That's pretty strange. Okay, another portion of the book that I wanted to ask you about was you have a pretty sweet chapter in the end about SETI.
Oh, yeah.
Can you discuss this portion of the book, and then also as an author, sort of like the editorial choice, why did you include it in the book?
Well, let me take the second question first.
Okay.
The number one thing that most newspaper or magazine or TV people point to and say, you know, you guys are all whacked, is, you know, SETI. They say, well, we're searching for extraterrestrial life. That's what SETI's mission is. These are the top scientists in the world that have decided to focus on this. If there was anything to your crashes, and let alone hardware proof or any of this stuff, they would know about it, and they would have been focused on it. And they're not, so it's all junk. And I wanted to just really lay into the hypothesis and the core elements of SETI and even some of the people of SETI and show why the entire supposition for search for extraterrestrial intelligence is ill-designed. And it's more of an exercise in, just goof-off.
Yeah.
Playing with fancy sensors and listening to radio waves from the stars rather than any strategic, well-thought experiment that is consistent with what we know about just even the evolution of our own race. We know that, radio waves are started, 150 years ago or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and most people will easily agree that they're only going to last another 150 years.
Yeah.
And so you got this 300-year window across a life of a civilization that's a million, 10 million, 100 million years old. That's an advanced civilization might live that long.
Yeah.
And so just from the get-go, it's not a very good indicator of possible intelligent life. And because the media touts this out, I wanted to just try to really lay into the strategic framework of SETI and point out the issues and problems with SETI and the fact that it's dumb.
Yeah.
And as Stan Friesman says, it's a silly effort to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to put it in there and talk about it and bring up some of the people, Frank Drake's linkages to naval top secret classified programs and the fact that they've had animal mutilations right there at some of their facilities, their heavy linkages to the CIA and the Robertson panel and MJ-12 and Vannevar Bush and so forth. And so I wanted to lay down the gauntlet and put it in their face.
Yeah.
And show that, hey, nobody has really done that, that this is it's just stupid. And so I haven't really – I'm about ready with a little more work on parts and physical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get to the point in 6 months or a year to really take it to the SETI guys.
Nice.
To, call them out, to send them the book, to start writing press releases, start making a stir and not only heavily attack, but at the same time back it up with, well, here's some parts from a crashed UFO, which are clearly extraterrestrial, according to all these metallurgical scientists, and your entire proposition is a waste of money. And
yeah.
Give me the money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And let's try to do some real research.
Yeah.
So that's that's the sort of plan with SETI. I want to not only deconstruct the propositions of SETI, but the funders of SETI too. I want to embarrass them for their stupidity. And, you know, God, I don't know. It's been Microsoft and Intel and several other big corporations that have plowed in hundreds of millions of dollars to this. And for what?
Exactly.
Just to keep some PhDs stroking their chin.
Yeah.
In a stupid way and ignoring the data that's in their face.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, that's my soapbox.
Well, it's a great chapter in the book, and I really enjoyed it. I'm no SETI fan myself, so I enjoyed it a lot. And like you intimated in the book, that ufology could use the money that's being foolishly wasted in SETI, like this Paul Allen telescope array thing that they're building. You know, if just a small percentage of the money they're throwing into that thing could be put into ufology, we could crack this thing overnight.
Yeah, we'd make a lot of progress.
And you sort of, there was a situation in the book where you sort of suggest maybe that that the government either infiltrated SETI or took over military control of SETI or something like that to try and make sure that in the event that they got something, that the government made sure that they knew what to do with it next. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement. I think that Drake was part of MJ-12 or was briefed into it, and that they are the cover story. I mean, the MJ-12 group had Donald Menzel writing anti-UFO books from his high post in astronomy at Harvard, and was a lead disinformation guy. And SETI is the lead disinformation tool about ET presence.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is that it's not terribly cloak and dagger. It's the thing that's out there in front that you have to wade through and rebut if you're in a major media situation. So that's what it will get whacked. The question is when.
Yeah, the sooner the better.
Right.
At the end of the book, also, there's sort of another little subchapter on Tim Cooper, the documents he got, and I believe it's Thomas Cantwheel. Is that the guy's name?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And there's even a very compelling, what's the word? A copy, I guess, would be the word of a letter that Cantwell wrote to Tim Cooper that was sort of chilling in a way.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about Tim Cooper, how he got these documents, and who this Cantwell character was?
Sure. Well, Tim Cooper is a UFO researcher that filed a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests in the early 90s or maybe even the late 80s about UFOs and various aspects of military intelligence. And he is the son of Harry B. Cooper, who was a printer I think, Coleman Air Force Base, and printed a bunch of top secret classified documents and did photographs and so forth all about UFOs. He was in the United States UFO, Air Force UFO program.
Yeah.
And I think it's because his father was in the program and that his father's friends may have met young Tim, you know, when he was a toddler.
Yeah.
To a small boy. And then later in life to discover that he has an interest in this field, he became a conduit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, most people ask, well, why Tim Cooper? You know, it's just a random guy.
Yeah.
Actually, Tim is very interested in the Kennedy assassination and more fascinated with religious implications and the Kennedy assassination than he was with UFO material. But he successfully started filing these Freedom Information requests, and I think that some of the declassifiers, people that review the materials and decide to declassify it, typically are retired people of the era that were there, that, you know, are doing this because they have a top secret clearance and they're 70.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of those people knew Tim Cooper and knew his father and decided to leak.
Yeah.
Out of remorse, or out of, you know, disgust of where it's gone. And I think that's what happened in the case of Thomas Cantwell, which is a pseudonym. And I think Cantwell knew his Tim Cooper's father and then released a lot of documents from his own files directly into the mail system to Tim Cooper's mailbox in Big Bear Lake and via other methods. There was a couple things that were mailed from the CIA and from Fort Meade and had their postage return mark stamps on that. So that's sort of why Tim, and Tim was a recipient of a lot of different documents, some of them original documents, you know, no photocopies, but original onion skin on watermarked and, you know, with typewriter marks and real inks and lots of forensic testing capable. So that's an exciting part. But the final letter, which is a tribute to Cantwell, really, who facilitated and enabled this whole book to happen. It goes, "Dear Mr. Cooper, by the time you read this letter reaches you, I will have left this world. I have cancer and don't have much time. There are many things to tell you about the 1947 New Mexico discoveries that I was personally involved in, but the grave beckons me most earnestly and will have to wait any longer." And what's interesting here is the use of the word New Mexico discoveries.
Yeah.
It sounds like they didn't say crashes. He called them discoveries.
Yeah.
I suppose that they were discoveries. I mean, they crashed, and then somebody found them and discovered them. Where was the note? Yeah, at the end, he goes, "In closing, I can only add that the UFO secret has been a costly one, not only in the lost credibility by the government." This is actually one of the, you know, biggest things of why they're not telling the truth now is, would you really trust your government more if they say, well, for the past 60 some odd 70 years, we've been hiding the UFO secret and we've done a really good job of it, and we got bodies and all sorts of stuff. Boy, most people would say, what else are you hiding?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, how are we going to fix this?
Exactly.
Lost credibility by the government, but in human lives as well. During my service for CIA and CIC, the Counterintelligence Corps, I committed many distasteful and sometimes regrettable acts of skullduggery in interests of national security for my superiors, and I now will be rewarded for my sins. Live a long and rewarding life, Tim, and add a word of caution along with it. In caps, trust no one completely. So, you know, regrettable acts is in, it's basically an admission of murder. There's other documents that talk about regrettable acts, and clearly in the case of Forrestal, and he was murdered. So, you know, here's a, you know, a counterintelligence and CIA operative that did all sorts of skullduggery and murders to keep the secret a secret.
Yeah.
Not only probably of U.S. citizens, but of foreign assets and, you know, who knows to what ends they would go to capture new technology and gain control over, you know, the Soviets or the Bolivians or whoever's got it.
Yeah. And he, in that letter, he also alludes, he apologizes for giving him some false information or something like that. Is that like a problem that came along with the Cooper documents, that some of them were mixed, some disinformation was mixed in? And do you ever explain why he did that?
Well, yeah, I think he mentions it in there, that he said that he had to do it to ensure plausible deniability. But he also reassures Tim that the content is accurate, but he changed dates and places and made some minor, you know, corrections to ensure that he would have plausible deniability in the public.
Yeah.
And possibly to protect himself, but I don't believe so. So, but when you look at the documents, you start analyzing each sentence,
yeah,
each phrase for its truth, for mm-hmm. veracity. I really haven't found anything that's manipulated and compellingly fraudulent.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few things that have, you know, signatures that are identical, and there's a few documents, you know, a handful out of the 3,500 pages that are what Stan Friedman considers boilerplate or emulations, where one's copied from another. But even when you study the emulations, they're not identical. You know, the word counts don't match. There's different phrasing. They're similar. And you could easily imagine a secretary who's used to writing all sorts of orders, you know, just having her superior or general walk in and say, yeah, work up some directives to send, you know, General Twining to New Mexico for this crash retrieval thing, you know, the usual sort of thing, and the secretary would just type it,
yeah,
and change a little. But she's typed hundreds of them before,
yeah, exactly.
And then to think that the general would sit down in longhand and write out precisely what he wants to say, it's ludicrous. I mean, it's sort of, he'd probably give the secretary that initial instruction. She'd type it up, hand him a draft. He'd look at it and say, oh, yeah, add this, type it again. It's gone. And,
yeah.
So without really digging deeper and vetting these subtleties, you know, each document has to be taken on its own merits. And some are more fully investigated and validated, like the Special Operations Manual,
mm-hmm.
Which is central to this book, Extraterrestrial Entities, Technology, Recovery, and Disposal, that we've vetted it every which way, and there's virtually nothing more we can do. There's a few things left, but, you know, we're in the 99% confidence level that it's true and authentic.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, a how-to manual on how to cordon off the area, grab the bodies, create a cover story, where to ship the stuff. I mean, it's pretty damn clear that they crash, and here's what to do.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the infamous Psalm 101 document that's pretty well known in ufology. And you say it's central to the book. Well, Like, pretty much kind of explain why it's central to the book, because it's a manual on how to retrieve crashes, and that's pretty much why you include it in the book, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And a complete replica is in there, as well as the my father's response to the concerns about authenticity. You know, there was five skeptics that got together and wrote a piece about, you know, why they think it's not real, and all those issues have been dealt with, and there's a whole chapter, or not chapter, but sort of addendum of three, four pages that discusses those issues.
Yeah.
So it's important to the book because we're so confident it's authentic and that it's so much on point for crash retrievals.
Exactly.
And that's why it's a key element in the introduction and the appendix.
Yeah.
To the book Magic Eyes Only.
Yeah, it's an important addition because it, you know, it's not just it's the crashes from the other side of the fence, pretty much. You know, it's sort of like their perspective on the crashes, the insiders. Moving on from the book, it's sort of a contemporary question, and that is sort of a pet question I have. I have two pet questions that I ask everybody, it seems, nowadays. The first one is on Serpo. Have you heard? I assume you've heard of the Serpo story that's going around, and given your wealth of documents and what have you, what can you lend to this story, if anything?
Well, I haven't followed it too much. I think my father's been following it closer. I think it's fascinating, intriguing. It seems to have hints and hallmarks of authenticity, but at the same time, baggage. It's in my, you know, as Stan Friedman calls, gray basket.
Yep,
I'm sort of real busy on lots of the things, and I'm sort of letting time pass on it. I'd love to see some real documents, or rather than just stories and things like that. So far, it hasn't been too whacked out to say that it's not believable. There's problems with virtually everything that you look at, but I like the fact that it's bouncing around. I mean, it's clear it's not a disinformation ploy. The government isn't doing it to confuse the situation. It just draws more attention.
Yeah.
So it's either the delusional efforts of a couple wackos or a wacko that just wants fame and attention, or it's real.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
we sort of let the test of time work its magic on this one.
Yeah, that's sort of my attitude right now, and let it get a little more vetting and. Mm-hmm. When I get some more time, maybe I'll dig into it. But, you know, somebody ought to dedicate themselves to being a Serpo expert. I mean, in my mind, it boils down to just all the best you're going to have at the end of the day is good stories.
Yeah.
I'm saying, you know, that doesn't cut the mustard. What you need is you got to have parts.
Yeah.
You got to have physical evidence. You got to have proof. You got to have witnesses. You got to have much more than just good stories and witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to some extent, it's a diversion from the motherlode.
Yeah.
And that's the baggage of it.
Yeah.
In the end, we're going to have to drag the parts and the technology and the economic advantage through the media and through the press and through society and the science community and to get them before they're going to realize that it's genuine.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of a comment about psychics, you know. If you're so psychic, how come you aren't rich? And, you know, if UFOs are real, how come you aren't rich? And until you can respond to that question and say, well, yeah, I got four patents, I got a bunch of money in this, and yeah, I am getting really rich.
Yeah.
And this corporation's getting really rich on this technology. Then they sort of shut up.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are corporations getting rich on this all the time, but the linkage and the proof back to ET hardware is hidden.
Yeah. And my other pet question that I ask a lot of people on this one is less contemporary, totally less contemporary, actually. But since you're sort of in the realm of documents and everything, the APRO files, I ask a lot of people about these because apparently when APRO went under and the Lorenzans died, the documents and the files went into the hands of someone else, and now they're pretty much gone. What do you know about the APRO documents? And there's probably a lot of crashes in there that we can't get our hands on, really, you think?
I think there's a lot of interesting data in there that I'd love to get my hands on. And John Schussler, the international director of MUFON, knows the people that has them. They're in a warehouse, and he has been unsuccessful in negotiating for their ownership. And I've told him, and the board has told, discussed it, the board of MUFON.
Yeah.
To say that, you know, this is real important and we should be getting on this. And I think the long and short of it is that they're probably available, but MUFON doesn't have the type of money that the guy wants. You know, I don't know what the answer is, but if you call them up and said, you know, well, will $100,000 do? He will say, well, yeah, or, well, that's a good starting point.
Yeah.
Will $250,000 do? Well, that should do it. I think the answer is something like that.
Yeah.
And, or they're just going to sit there.
Yeah.
And I think they're not going to get destroyed. But that's where it's at.
Yeah, that's
mind.
It. Yeah, I've always, I had seen Walt Andrus at last year's X conference, and he gave a speech, and he was talking about the evolution of various UFO groups, and that APRO, the missing APRO documents and files story, sort of stuck with me, and I always end up asking the guests about that and if they know much about it or what they think of that, because it's a strange sort of turn of events, but it sounds like from what you're saying that it's a money issue almost. This guy must think he's
taking on just,
money.
Yeah, I think it's just cut a deal. I think it's nothing more than you know, cut a deal to get him. You know, he may say, well, you know, you have to preserve the original ones, and you have to cite credit, and you know, you have to do the appropriate archive library thing.
Yeah.
But all that stuff's manageable. Now, I'll give you one interesting story as a tidbit about Walt Andrus, and I was shocked, is that for many years when Walt Andrus was the head of MUFON, he routinely got all sorts of reports from all over the world about UFOs, and he gave them to somebody to sort of review and vet.
Yeah.
And probably 2/3 of them were thrown away.
Oh, man.
Right, because Walt Andrus's, you know, vetter thought they weren't much to him. And, and you know, when John Schussler took over, that practice stopped immediately, and so forth. And so this is the stuff that just drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, is there a possibility that Walt Andrus was either just stupid or was deliberately letting somebody, you know, spin the data and minimize the data and impact. I know that seems kind of harsh. He's a wonderful man. He did a lot of great work, and you know, he deserves a lot of accolades for running MUFON for such a long time. But at the same time, I'm surprised.
Yeah, that's a tremendous mistake.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. Your website, majesticdocuments.com, tell us a little bit about that. I suggest people check it out. It's got a wealth of material. So, you know, sort of talk about that a little bit, because if you haven't checked out majesticdocuments.com, you're missing out on tons of stuff.
Yeah, Majestic Documents is sort of the work on the documents. I mean, the 3,500 pages, you can download the various documents themselves. You can see various products. You can buy this stuff in many different forms, in book form instead of downloading it. You know, it's the results of a lot of work that's been done. We have sort of an investigation team. There's several papers on authentication that discuss in more detail different aspects. There's a famous UFO quotes PowerPoint. The paper I wrote on, or paper my dad wrote on, mounting evidence for authenticity of MJ-12 documents. I have the Cape Girardeau crash up there, a paper that I wrote. There's a paper that I wrote on psychological warfare in the Majestic documents, Little Evidence of Deception. 10 Reasons Why Tim Cooper Is Not a Providence Problem, and, you know, not a faker.
Yeah.
So there's things like that, as well as pictures and witnesses and official documents from the Freedom of Information Act and British Records, Public Records Office, and the National Archives and Records Administration, and NICAP and Truman Library. And there's the Majestic Personnel page, where you can go there and look at the master MJ-12 list that has complete listing of everybody that I think is linked to MJ-12, name, rank, serial number, social security number, date of birth, why they're critical.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of data there.
It's a great website.
Pretty big site.
Yeah, I definitely suggest people check it out, majesticdocuments.com. It's a great place for research and a whole host of avenues you can go down there once you check it out. The other thing I want to talk to you about, the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference. This is you and your dad put this on. You've had three now, correct?
Yeah, three.
Okay, three. How did it come about? How has it evolved? What's it like running your own conference? Tell me about the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference. Before you do, I've heard just amazingly good things about the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, and I'm not kissing your butt here. This is the truth, because everybody I talk to who's gone always says it's awesome. All the people who are on the show who speak there always tell me, you got to check out the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference. Sounds like the place to be as far as conferences goes. It's one of the best of the conferences out there that I've heard of. So tell me about it, how did it come about, like I said, how has it evolved, and, you know, what's it like running it?
Well, it sort of evolved because I became personally disgusted with going to the other conferences and getting a cross section of goo. A couple of talks were great, and the rest of it was just like, oh my God, how in the world did they ever let this guy on the stage? and so I said, hey, I'm just going to make my own conference, and I'm going to focus on what I consider the core thing, and that is the crash retrievals. And so that's what I decided to do, and we're coming up here on the fourth one, November 10th through 12th, in 06 at the Tuscany in Las Vegas, and we should have 300-400 people there. We've got a pretty good lineup this year. We typically have at least four, sometimes as many as six different crash retrievals that are talked about just by one speaker and then some other aspects. This year we got Stan Friedman talking about why UFOs crash. Michael Sala is going to give an overview of crashed UFO black operations. We typically have a speaker panel and press conference on Friday night, and everybody gives a little 5-minute summary. Rich Dolan will be there and have part two of his two-volume set, UFOs in the National Security State from 1973 to 2006. He's working hot and heavy on that right now, and
yep.
By the fall we'll have it done. Paul Shatskin, who's done a couple of biographies, and he's working on T. Townsend Brown, a famous sort of anti-gravity, electrogravitics person, and I'm going to have him talking about the linkages of him to the UFO field and to the government and so forth. I typically have one sort of in-depth biography of an interesting person that was either murdered by MJ-12 or relevant to this process. Mm-hmm. I'm giving a talk on a brand new crash retrieval that's not in my book. It's one of the masks, the new 11 that I've got, and I hope to have some real breathtaking info about that. I mean, it's a good story right now, but with a little more research, I may have hardware.
Awesome.
So that should light people up. And then Michael Lindemann, who's talking about scenarios of contact. He's been a facilitator of when he worked for Joe Firmage of a group of 20 people or so that went over a couple of weekends that talked about scenarios of contact, and he'll be reporting the results of that high-level investigation. They had a lot of military generals and scientists, and it was a very interesting event. And you know, why they're contacting or what the implications of contact are in an open society, I think, is an important discussion.
Yeah.
And then I'm still working on a keynote speech, trying to get some people. My dad and Nick Redfern are going to be talking about crashed UFOs and biowarfare. My dad is finishing up his first book on alien viruses.
Oh, boy.
And that should be very interesting. Frank Fascino is going to talk about the Braxton County Monster. He's completely redone his book. He had a disappointing experience with his publisher, and they hacked through a bunch of it and screwed it all up. And,
oh, man.
So he's redone it and made it a much more scholarly, stronger book.
Awesome.
Linda Howe will be back to give an update on her 53 and some other crash disk informants and so forth. I got Bruce McAbee to come talk about the El Indio Guerrero December 6, 1950 UFO crash, and I'm helping him with that, getting some more data, new data people haven't seen. Matthew Thuney is going to talk about the Lumini Island incident off of sort of an underwater Roswell event. Here's a new one, Peter Merlin. His talk's After the Fire, How the Government Responds to Top Secret Crashes.
Oh,
he is basically a crashed airplane expert.
Yeah.
He's been to hundreds of crashes, including the stealth fighter that crashed outside Bakersfield, and he's giving a talk on sort of what they do and how they respond when something important crashes. How's the site sanitized? Did they remove every trace?
Mm-hmm.
And so forth. He's an aerospace archaeologist. And so it should be very interesting because he's not in the UFO field per se, but he's bringing an important skill dimension to this topic.
Yeah.
And so that's the cross section of our conference, and UFOconference.com has all the data. And if you go to the website, you can register online or fax it in and see the.
And that's UFOconference.com.
Yeah, UFOconference.com.
Awesome. Well, I can almost guarantee that I will be there this year at the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4. So,
okay, good.
We'll finally get a chance to meet up. That's November 10th to the 12th.
Yeah.
Aside from that, that's obviously a huge event. I can't wait to check it out. What's next for Ryan Wood? What do you have in the pipeline? Like you said, you got these 11 cases you're looking into. What else is up?
Well, I have a real job too. So the answer is work on some of these cases, manage my conference, that's about it for the time being.
Awesome.
So that's my focus. You know, if there's any place that I want to go, and that is more towards parts, more towards physical evidence, get some more parts in context that are traceable directly out of the ground as being linked to a crash retrieval.
Yeah. Any conferences that you'll be speaking at or anything that you want to mention for the summer?
Well, yeah, I'll be like speaking at the MUFON conference in July here in Denver about my research and book and so forth.
Yep.
And then I'll be speaking also at the Bay Area UFO Expo in September.
Okay.
Again, about my research and book, and then the November conference.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show. The book, like I said, is really amazing. It's a fun read. 74 UFO crash reports are in there, plus the extra section on SETI, some stuff on Thomas Cantwheel, the reprint of the Psalm 101 document. There's tons of stuff in there. The book, Magic Eyes Only, you can find that under magiceyesonly.com, the website. You also have the website majesticdocuments.com, which we talked about. That's a wealth of information. And also, as you said, the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4 coming November. And you can find out more about that at ufoconference.com. Ryan Wood, thank you very much. The book is really amazing. Magic Eyes Only. It was a fun read. Thanks for being on the show. I had a great time talking to you.
Well, thank you.
That does it for this week's edition of Been All of America Audio. I want to thank Ryan Wood for sitting down talking to us for so long. Lots of cool information there. The websites, let me roll them out for you one more time. For the book, it's Magic Eyes Only, MagiceyesOnly.com. For the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference 4, it is ufoconference.com. And for the Majestic Documents, it is majesticdocuments.com. That's the trifecta of websites. Check them out. Lots of great information on Majestic Documents at majesticdocuments.com, how to find out about the book at magiceyesonly.com, and how to find out about the critically acclaimed UFO Crash Retrieval Conference at ufoconference.com. I want to thank also Leslie, Chiron, and R. Lee of BeenAllOfAmerica.com for your help and support with the audio series and the website. Check out their columns at BeenAllOfAmerica.com. Leslie's on Tuesday, Chiron on Wednesday, R. Lee every other Monday or so. You're going to just check in on Mondays and R. Lee may show up. You never know. She's a trickster. And, of course, we have tons of other stuff at BeenAllOfAmerica.com, updated daily. So if you aren't getting your daily dose of BeenAllOfAmerica.com, there's something wrong with you. You need to check out the website. I want to also give a shout-out and a plug and a mention to Leslie's ghost photo contest that's ongoing. We've been talking about it here on Been All of America Audio for the last few weeks. It is winding down. The last day to enter your ghost photo is May 28th. That's this Sunday at midnight Eastern Time. Go to ghostphotocontest.blogspot.com for information on how to enter, for information on the fabulous prizes, for information on the many ghost pictures that have already been entered. The voting, I presume, will start next week, but for now, if you get the ghost photo, if you've been sitting on a classic ghost photo that you want us to see, put it up there, ghostphotocontest.blogspot.com. That's the contest. Cool prizes. Check it out. If you're a longtime listener of BeenAllOfAmerica.com and you want to help us out, it would be hugely appreciated. It would help offset the costs of the BOA empire greatly. If you can make a donation, that would be killer. Click on the PayPal button at BeenAllOfAmerica.com and see what you can do. I'd appreciate it. Next week on Been All of America Audio, it is BOA Audio taking on pop culture as only we can. James Gutman, author of World Wrestling Insanity. I'm a longtime wrestling fan. I wanted to spice it up a little bit. I know James, so there's a special rapport there. He and I worked together on his audio series. So I said, hey, why don't you come on Been All of America Audio? I always can see a tie-in between the esoteric and the most esoteric sport out there, professional wrestling. So we're going to talk about the inside workings of this wacky industry, how one family and their crazy politics shape what you see on TV twice a week, sometimes three times a week. We're going to be talking about how there's no wrestlers' union and how there's an epidemic of wrestler deaths going on that is barely mentioned by the mainstream media. Pretty much, it's going to be esoteric look at professional wrestling. You're going to want to be here for that one, folks. It is going to be killer. That's next week on Banal of America Audio 636. Be there or be square. Until you hear from me next week, this is Tim Banal, signing off.